Okay. Welcome to the hybrid John Jay Homestead and to our temporary venue. The parking is improved over the homestead, but we do miss our ballroom. I'm Melissa Vail, trustee of the Friends and chair of the lecture committee. And we're excited to have so many of you here in person and many more on screen. Welcome especially to the teachers and students in both parts of our audience. And please turn off your phones. Thank you. I think mine is off. First, some webinar logistics for our remote attendees. You're all muted and the video of you is turned off. If you have technical problems, please use the chat function for messages to our host. After this introduction, our speaker will speak. And we already have some questions for her, but we welcome more. So please use the chat feature for that too. We hope to be able to take a lot of your questions. Thank yous to the Bedford Playhouse for taking us in during the closing of Bedford House and watched the homestead site for news of exciting construction and reinterpretation projects. Special thanks to our lectures committee for their indispensable support of these talks listed back here. And to our outstanding public partner, the New York State Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation, for everything. And as always, and most important, to our members who are our reason for being. Quick show of hands, how many of you here are already members? Good. There's room for some additions there. We don't want to have it be completely filled up yet. Thank you. We have two more dates for this series titled Revolutions listed on the back of your program. On Thursday, April 27th, we have Linda Colley on The Gun, the Ship, and the Pen, Warfare, Constitutions, and the Making of the Modern World. And on Tuesday, May 23rd, Sarah Cedar Miller, Before Central Park, which coincides with our annual meeting, so we won't be charging for that. Now, here is a Zoom feature that we're keeping, the survey. I'm going to ask you a question, and I want a lightning response, no overthinking. Our finest mathematicians will report on our in-person and online answers, which often come in differently in an interesting way. Here's the survey. I'll read the questions, and then I'll give you a chance to vote on them. Which decision of the 20 to 21 term do you think will have the greatest long-term impact? First Amendment free exercise, affirmative action, voting rights, independent state legislature, gun rights, reproductive rights. Six choices. I'm sorry to give you so many, but there's so much happening. So now I'm going to read them again and you're going to vote.
Melissa, could I interrupt? Yes. You say the 2021 term. I think you're melding.
Probably am.
Yeah.
So which one? Independent state legislature probably shouldn't be in there, right?
Correct.
Okay. Then let's take out independent state legislature and we'll get to that later.
And Dobbs was in the 21-22 term.
But it's in your book.
When they agreed to hear it, not when they decided.
Okay. Right. So you think that's cheating? I want to keep it in.
Well, keep cheating. That's okay. Right. All right.
Okay. So First Amendment free exercise.
That was okay. Fulton. That was the Fulton case, I think.
Okay. So small number of votes for that. Affirmative action. Small number of votes for that. Voting rights. Lots. Okay. I would say that's 40% of the audience. Okay. Gun rights. That's probably 10%. And reproductive rights. Okay. That's less. So the most votes went for voting rights, then reproductive rights, then gun rights. Okay. How about, are we ready with an online response yet, or do we mix that in later? Emily or Heidi, do you have something for us? Good. Okay. There we go. When we asked that, never mind. That's too long a story. We don't have time for it. Okay, the last part from me before you get to hear our speaker. Those of you who've come to our talks before know that we always look for a Jay connection to the topic of the evening. Tonight's story has to do with Jay's Huguenot ancestry, with a nod to all the First Amendment cases discussed by our speaker. Huguenots, of course, were French Protestants who were expelled from France by Louis XIV in 1685. They could either convert to Catholicism, go to prison or a convent, or flee the country. About 200,000 did leave, many of them from the French port of La Rochelle, and they then founded the Westchester town of New Rochelle, where the football team is called the Huguenots. So John Jay inherited a healthy commitment to free exercise of religion, but also some suspicion of the Catholic Church, to the extent that he proposed a provision in New York State's Constitution, of which he was the principal author, that would require a test oath for applicants for citizenship and candidates for state office to renounce foreign ecclesiastical power, i.e. the Pope. Remember, oaths were a serious business. Lincoln said that oaths were registered in heaven. Both of Jay's proposals failed, one because he withdrew it and the other because it was voted down. And it's argued that he wasn't animated totally by anti-Catholic sentiment, but also by fears that the Pope could absolve a citizen from guilt for violating his oath to the Constitution. Then the federal Constitution, which took in many provisions from New York's, put in Article 6, which requires that all federal and state legislators swear or affirm to support the federal Constitution, but goes on to say that no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. So hard-fought issues. Now our speaker, Linda Greenhouse, is the Knight Distinguished Journalist in Residence and Joseph Goldstein Lecturer in Law at Yale Law School. Currently an opinion writer for the New York Times, she reported for the Times from 1968 to 2008, serving as the newspaper's Supreme Court correspondent, and received a 1998 Pulitzer Prize in journalism for beat reporting. She's the author of four other books about the court and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And I hope you all saw her piece in today's New York Times, "Where Will the Supreme Court Draw the Line on Guns?" Welcome, Linda Greenhouse. So the first question before we get on to your marvelous book.
Can I just say, in thanking you, and my first reporting assignment for the Times when I was a baby reporter was to cover Westchester County. I was the only Times reporter assigned to Westchester County. We had an office in White Plains, and I spent the first, year or so of that job getting lost. But once I knew my way around and started meeting people, I made lifelong friends in the county, and I'm just happy to be back here. So thank you.
Shouldn't have taken that long to get you back. So with our survey answers, are we right? Which of the decisions is going to have the longest impact?
Okay, so you did conflate a bunch of terms and a bunch of cases.
Yep.
So I think the only two cases that actually were decided during the term that you identified were the voting rights case from Arizona, which has not gotten enough attention, but was, I think, will prove to be very consequential. I could say more about it, but I won't now unless people want me to. And the free exercise case from Philadelphia, a case called Fulton, which had to do with whether a Catholic social service agency had the right under the free exercise clause not to abide by the non-discrimination provision of the Philadelphia ordinance and could keep refusing to certify same-sex couples as potential foster parents. And the court issued a contorted opinion in which the church won, but they kind of avoided the bigger question. So I think religion is extremely important on this court's agenda. That case did not turn out to be as important as most people thought it would. So I think those who voted for the voting rights case, if that's the case they had in mind, were correct. Yeah.
And maybe we're talking about trends too, and not just specific cases, but Brnovich is a big deal. About your book, when did you decide to write it and why? I mean, I know it's a pandemic book, but so tell us how that came about.
Right. So in our audience is a very distinguished, literary agent, Pat Haas. So she knows how these things work. So in the fall of 2020, I was sitting around and my agent called me and said, Random House is interested in your writing a kind of a quick book that would chronicle the 2021 term of the Supreme Court, to which Amy Coney Barrett had just been confirmed, making her the third Trump justice. And obviously the court had changed drastically in the wake of RBG's death. And so chronicle what's going to happen. So I said yes. And the deal was they wanted to publish the book as close as possible to the start of the next term, the first Monday in October of 2021. That's a really fast turnaround for a book. So what it required, what they told me it was going to require, was writing it chapter by chapter and turning it in. So that was, challenging. And I kind of needed a challenge because nothing else was happening in this days of the deepest pandemic. So I said yes, and I got to work. So that's how it happened.
And so you basically turned in month by month your chapters.
Yes. So I decided the way to do it would be chronologically rather than thematically or something like that. So so the first chapter of the book was actually a look back, and it's called The Triumph of John Roberts. And by what I meant by that was that in the previous term, when he had achieved a pretty solid working majority, he was a winner in everything that mattered, and certainly everything that mattered to him. He was coming off a great term. And so I talked about what had happened in that term and raised the question, going forward, now that he has five justices to his right, in other words, a majority of the court that really doesn't need him, will it still be the Roberts Court by the end of the term? So that was a kind of a sort of an organizing principle. Of course, I didn't know the answer to that question. And we can see going forward, it's quite plausible to say, no, it ceased to be the Roberts Court. Maybe it became the Alito Court. Maybe it became the Clarence Thomas Court. You pick them. Because as people know, the chief was not on board the Alito opinion that overturned Roe against Wade. And he really seemed to be kind of outflanked on a number of important cases. So that was sort of I won't say unifying theme. Month by month book didn't.
Well,
didn't
you started
have that.
Out with a through line.
It was a through line. Thank you. That's the word.
So was there, at different points of the through line, you got to have been tempted to go back and make some changes in the drafts that hadn't been, set in type yet. Were they, or where do you think you were most prescient, and where do you think you missed what was unfolding?
So I don't actually think I missed anything. By that time I've been covering the court or closely following the court for, I hate to confess, 40 years. So I have a pretty good nose for what's coming. I guess if there was one thing I would have changed, but it doesn't implicate any through line, but there was the kind of final dying gasp of the effort to undo the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, that term. It was a very weird case. It was a ridiculous case, in fact. But of course, the Trump administration was in it with both feet. And it was clear after the argument was, I think, in December, that this attack on Obamacare was not going to work. And I wrote that at the time after the argument. What I didn't perceive was that it was going to fail, not on its merits, but fail because the red states that had brought this cockamamie lawsuit were deemed, in an opinion by Justice Clarence Thomas, of all people, not to have standing. The case was flawed from the beginning. The case should never have been brought. So that was the end of that. And I hadn't really picked up on how serious the challenge to the state standing was. But I think that's the only thing I would have changed, actually.
And was that a rescue by finding a standing reason to allow ACA to go forward? Or was it?
No, was I mean, legit? So the conservative justices used to be quite concerned about giving states standing to just come in on policy grounds and say, you know, we don't like this or that and the other thing, and we're making up some reason why we're entitled to be in court. The conservatives were very skeptical of that. Less so now because the red states are suing the Biden administration. But so I don't think they were trying to rescue Obamacare. I think they were trying to put the states in their place and say, no, you can't just, you know, bulldoze your way into court. And that proved to be important because around that same time, of course, the 2020 election had taken place. And the Trump people cobbled up another crazy lawsuit brought by the state of Texas, actually, suing in the Supreme Court under the court's original jurisdiction, which means it did come up through a lower court, suing directly in the Supreme Court, three swing states that had gone for Biden. And Texas was claiming that we, Texas, have the right to reopen the way elections were conducted in these three states. And you, Supreme Court justices, are going to give us the power to do that. No, actually, no, that did not go anywhere. So the question of state standing sounds very technical, but it's crucially important. And the justices know exactly how important it is. And so that was not an insignificant decision when they kicked the states out on the Obamacare case.
When you moved from reporter to opinion writer, did you unleash yourself at all? Or would your reporting be equally candid and skeptical if you were still doing news and not opinion?
So I left the Times in 2008. I took a buyout and I took a second career job at teaching at Yale Law School. And after about a year, the guy who was then running the op-ed page of the Times asked me if I would write a column about the court every 2 weeks. So that was really a change because it's an opinion column. And of course, an opinion column without an opinion is a failure. So it has to have an opinion. That's the point of it. So, you know, of course, I always had opinions, but as a daily reporter, that wasn't my job to tell people what to think. And now it kind of became. So it was an interesting transition. And what I, you know, quickly discerned is that opinions are worthless anybody's opinion is worthless unless it's backed up by, you know, the hard job of reporting and really thinking something through. So one nice thing about writing a column like that, which is basically online, you know, occasionally in print, but basically it's online, is that part of the writer's job is to make the hyperlinks that people can click on and see the actual sources. So it's like a living, you know, bibliography in a way, or living footnotes. And so, you know, if I say, you know, some, as in today, the piece that's up on the website, say about guns, about the Second Amendment, I put in all those links to the lower court opinions and the briefs that were filed and the background of this amazing judge who wrote this amazing opinion, and all that kind of stuff. So there's still reporting involved, but it's reporting in the service of coming up with an argument that you hope will be persuasive, or else it's not worth doing.
The date of your preface in the paperback edition is July 4th. Is that a coincidence?
Yes, the fact that it was July 4th was a coincidence. It had to be a very fast turnaround just because for production reasons. So that, I guess that just happened to be the day. Yeah, it wasn't conscious. I was just working real hard to get it in on some kind of deadline. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So I just would love to go through the chapters in a lightning round.
Sure.
And have you tell us what you think were the blockbusters in each chapter. So the first chapter, which is July, was probably Amy Coney Barrett, right?
So the July was looking back on Chief Justice Roberts' great year, right?
Okay. August and September.
So that was the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg on that Friday night. I think it was September 18th. I remember it well because our daughter was favoring us with a visit from Los Angeles. And we were sitting having dinner and the phone rang and it was MSNBC saying, can you come on and discuss tonight's news? I said, what is tonight's news? And they said, Justice Ginsburg has died. So that was kind of a shock. I mean, it was quite a shock. What I didn't know at the time, of course, is that Mitch McConnell, the Republican majority leader at the time, had called President Trump, who was on a campaign plane, had gotten him in the air to say, Mr. President, you're going to fill this vacancy and you're going to fill it before the election. And of course, he did. And Trump named Amy Coney Barrett while Ruth Ginsburg's body was still lying in state in the U.S. Capitol. He summoned people to the Rose Garden. It became a COVID super spreader because, of course, nobody was vaccinated, and introduced Amy Barrett to the country. That came a little bit.
Yep.
That was October, I think. But yeah. But that was September was RBG's death. Yeah.
And then October was her confirmation, right. Lightning confirmation. November, exercise and COVID.
Yeah. So November, we see immediately what her arrival at the court in place of Justice Ginsburg meant. So earlier in the pandemic, when Ruth Ginsburg was still alive, there were a couple of lawsuits that made their way up to the Supreme Court from religious organizations challenging COVID restrictions on the number of people who could attend religious services and so on, claiming that this violated their free exercise rights. And the votes were 5-4 to reject these challenges. Chief Justice Roberts wrote in the first of these cases saying, you know, we are judges. We're not public health experts. We're having a public health crisis in this country, and we defer to the public health experts who say that the attendance at religious services should be limited to whatever. The minute Amy Barrett had a chance to weigh in on this, the court flipped 5-4 the other way, like right around Thanksgiving in a couple of cases. And that was a real indication of what was to come. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
December, Texas electors, and a whole lot of foreshadowing of January 6th.
Right. So there were a ton of post-election cases that came to the court. And fortunately, or you might say for better or worse, anyway, they were late in arriving. They were badly prepared. They just couldn't fly. People took some comfort from that, that the court rejected these cases. I don't actually take a lot of comfort. I think better presented cases, cases that were not trying to close the barn door after the horse was out, might well succeed on some of these theories. You raised a question earlier about the independent state legislature doctrine. So that was, there was, you know, suggestions of that in these cases. So it was a pretty tense time. We can look back and say, well, the court didn't involve itself in any of that. Well, that wasn't that 100% clear going into that month that the court would not put its finger on the scale for Trump. Certainly, President Trump, you know, was railing against, you know, I have my justices. What have they done for me? It was really pretty much out there. But that's December.
January. There are some big Sotomayor dissents. There's women's health. There's deference to agencies. There's Election Day.
Yeah. So the federal government had not executed anybody for a couple of decades. And as a very cynical campaign ploy, the Trump administration decided in the summer of 2020 that we need some executions to fire up the base. And so they designated 13 individuals for execution. Now, all these people had been convicted of capital murder, obviously. Some of them had some pretty good arguments as to why they should not be executed. But because it's very hard under current procedure to get a second look at a criminal conviction, these were very hard cases to bring. And so these challenges had either failed or were about to fail unless the court would intervene at the last minute. And the court did come in at the last minute to say, basically execute all of them. So one case at a time, the court rejected these last minute challenges. And, you know, I'm not saying that this was a group of innocent people, but these were people who had substantial procedural issues that a different court might well have considered worthy of further attention. And Justice Sotomayor dissented in all of these cases. And at the last execution, which was the weekend before Inauguration Day, Trump became the first president since the 19th century, in other words, more than 100 years, to preside over the execution of a federal prisoner after having been turned out of office by losing an election, right? And that's what he wanted to do. And so what Justice Sotomayor did in her final dissent from the final one of these was basically list all of them in one dissenting opinion. And I think I say in the book, or it certainly seemed to me anyway, it was her version of kind of from the Black Lives Matter movement, say their names, just say their names. And she did. And it was, she called it an execution spree, unseemly execution spree. And was pretty powerful, but there we are.
Here we are. February, the administrative state, Pennsylvania election recount.
Yeah. Trying to think of February. I guess there was the Pennsylvania case that a quite distinguished judge on the Federal Appeals Court in Philadelphia, Judge Bibas, Trump appointee, but he had been a law professor at Penn, said basically, you know, if you want us to hear you, you've got to have evidence, and you don't have any. So I'm rejecting this. And it was pretty interesting.
March, people start putting pressure, public pressure on Justice Breyer. And then there's Brnovich.
Yeah, I mean, one kind of through line in this whole year was the effort by a bunch of people on the liberal side to get Stephen Breyer to retire. And some of it was just so undignified. I mean, there was a sound truck that was driving around in circles around the Supreme Court building with Breyer retire, Breyer retire. I mean, and, you know, part of this was fueled by people's regret that RBG had not retired in time to allow President Obama to appoint her replacement. And that's an ongoing debate, and I'm sure some of you share that regret. So that kind of fueled the, okay, you know, Breyer, we now have, you know, a Democratic president, and now it's your turn. And that was going to happen later, but it didn't happen then.
April, New York State rifle and pistol.
New York State, hey, what?
Rifle and pistol.
Right. So the Heller decision that found for the first time a right under the Second Amendment for individuals to own a gun had come down in 2008. So this was 2021. And the court hadn't done anything to advance gun rights under Heller for all those years. And the conservatives on the court were loudly complaining about it, saying, we're turning the Second Amendment into a second-class right. Well, you know, I mean, really, that's like totally ridiculous, because every one of the rights that we enjoy has some kind of limitation. The First Amendment, the 14th. I mean, there's no right that's unlimited. Except evidently the Second Amendment should be. So they've been, you know, kind of bitching and moaning about this for a couple of years. By they, I mean Justice Thomas and Justice Alito in particular, Justice Gorsuch a little bit. So finally they grant one. And it was this case from New York that was decided, takes a while, was decided this past June outside my framework, but it was obvious in that when they granted this case that the game was afoot and there would be a Second Amendment case and there would be an expansion of the individual right under the Second Amendment. I should say for background, for people don't know, the court really has complete discretion over what cases to hear. So throughout the book, I pay a lot of attention to the cases that they're granting, because that's a discretionary act. It's a very important act. The court decides these days about 65 cases a year. They get about 6,000 petitions. So the grant of review is the disposition of a very scarce resource. So when they took this gun case from New York, which became the Bruin case that was decided in June, and that's now at issue in the case I wrote about in the Times this morning. That was a big deal.
May, Chapter 10, June medical, and the foreshadowing of Dobbs and Rowan Casey.
Right. So I think June Medical had been decided the previous year, abortion case. So they finally grant Dobbs. And when I say finally, so the Mississippi case that became Dobbs, Mississippi's defense of its 14-week abortion ban. There have been a lot of cases like that with the various red states serving up restrictions on abortion that were struck down by federal appeals courts. They had to be struck down because Roe was still good law, and the states would appeal, and the court would not grant, would not agree to hear these cases. Why would they? Because Roe was still good law. So the fact that they granted Dobbs, agreed to hear, the Mississippi law, of course, had been struck down by the Fifth Circuit, which is the court, the country's most conservative federal appeals court. But the Fifth Circuit had no choice but to strike it down because the Supreme Court rules, and the rule was still there's a right to abortion. The Mississippi appeal had come into the court in the summer of 2020. And then Justice Ginsburg died, and they kept sending the case, they kept relisting the case for conference week after week after week. I'll just digress to say the court has a very good website, supremecourt.gov, where kind of remarkably for those of us who came up in the old days when this information was like a state secret, the court makes public every intervening move on every pending case. And so every time a pending petition goes to the justices' private conference week after week after week, that's noted. So the list of conferences under Dobbs growing, growing, growing. The court wasn't doing anything with it. And the right wing, the anti-choice crowd, was getting very upset. Why aren't they granting this case? What does it mean? They're not granting it. Well, then in May, they grant it. And it's clear, I mean, it would seem clear to me that the only reason they granted it was they finally had the 5 votes to overturn Roe. There was no other reason to grant it. So
when people... Do you know who leaked that opinion, or do you think we'll ever know the Dobbs draft?
What, who leaked it?
Yeah.
It kind of seems like we're not going to know. I mean, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my strong sense is the leak came from the right. You know, everybody at first thought it came from the left, but that doesn't make sense. But what makes sense was it came from the right, because we know from subsequent leaks that, and we know the chief was not on board with Alito. And so the subsequent leak was that Chief Justice Roberts was trying to peel Brett Kavanaugh away from Alito, which would have deprived Alito of a majority, would have taken away his 5th vote. And so for the right wing to leak the draft, which had Kavanaugh's name on it as supporting the Alito opinion, would be then very embarrassing for Kavanaugh to flip, because the whole thing would have been public. So I think that was the motivation, but who did it? I have no idea.
No. And then the last one, June, just a quick minute on Espinoza, Montana tax credits for religious school tuition.
Yeah, so this was the kind of final case in a free exercise trilogy that the Chief Justice had written. And I won't go into all the details of it, but the basic holding here was there was a program in Montana of a kind of a voucher program where you could get tax credits. Parents could get tax credits for donating money to a nonprofit that would then subsidize private school tuition. But it excluded religious school tuition on the ground that that would violate the Establishment Clause. And the court said, that's discrimination against religion. And you can't carve religion out of any public benefit. And that actually flowed from the last of the COVID cases that the court decided that term, which I think was in April, a case called Tandon against Newsom. I'll just say a word about it because it was so extreme in showing us what had changed on the court. So California had passed a COVID emergency thing. It said that no more than, I think, four people could gather for any purpose in a home. It was four people, six people, something like that. So somebody sued and said, well, I have Bible study in my home. And you can't tell me that I can't have as many people as I like in my home for Bible study, because that's my religious right. And of course, that lost to the lower courts on the ground that religion wasn't being disabled in any way. It was just being treated like every other activity that you might have in your home, a birthday party or whatever. Comes up to the court, and the court said, oh no, because there are more people in hair salons or in, you know, different commercial things, that means that religion is not being treated as well as something else. And anytime religion is not treated as well as something else, and it's up for us to say what that something else, what that comparator might be, that violates free exercise. And so this Montana case, you take that COVID case and the Montana school tuition case together, you see that under this court, religion rules. That's the basic, that's the bottom line.
I'd like to talk a bit about the justices and the dynamics among them. And I'll start with a question about confirmation hearings. What are we going to do about them? I just want to say it's a nice night to ask this question because tomorrow is opening day. And Chief Justice Roberts memorably said in his confirmation hearings, it's my job to call balls and strikes, not to pitch or bat. So are hearings just performative now? Can they be made more reliable? What do you do if you want to appoint a politically independent candidate to be a justice? What do you do?
Well, it's just tragic. So, of course, after the book was published, we had the confirmation hearing last spring for Ketanji Brown Jackson, President Biden's distinguished nominee. And what the Republicans tried to do to her was just hard to watch. I mean, they pulled garbage out of the air. Well, you didn't give, you know, a long enough sentence to this child abuser when you were on the district court. And, you know, none of it made any sense. They did their best to diminish her and make her look unqualified. You know, she had clerked on the Supreme Court for Stephen Breyer. She had, you know, distinguished legal career. And it was racist. It was sexist. It was just disgusting. So to call it performative is actually too gracious a word. It was just smutty garbage. So what to do? I mean, I think if I could push a button and change something about the confirmation process now, it would be to bring back the filibuster. Now, why do I say that? So Mitch McConnell in 2017 abolished the filibuster, which is just governed by Senate rule. It's not a law. It's not in the Constitution. It's just up to the Senate to make its own rules. And the rule had been for a Supreme Court nominee, you need a supermajority. You need not just 51 votes, you need 60 votes. If that had been the rule, none of the three Trump justices would have been confirmed. But because McConnell got rid of the filibuster, they all were confirmed by 50 votes plus the vice president or 51 votes or whatever. So without the filibuster, and this could be true on the Democratic side too, the impulse for any president is to go as far to the right or as far to the left as you can and still get your 50 votes plus the vice president to break a tie. you know, other systems don't have this. I mean, the German Supreme Court, which is a very distinguished constitutional court, I think written into the German Constitution is a supermajority to confirm to the Supreme Court, which means that the drive is toward compromise and toward the middle. And, you know, if that could come back, I think it would be much better. But of course, neither side is going to engage in unilateral disarmament. So I can't imagine the Democrats, who now control the Senate, saying, oh, you know, here's a good idea for our civic life, bring back the filibuster. No, that's not going to happen. And the Republicans aren't going to do it either. So I don't see how the confirmation process is going to be fixed. And it's tragic. It's just bad for the country.
Akhil Amar, your Yale colleague and our speaker from 2017, says that the court has the highest approval ratings of any branch of government, and that he sees deep collegiality and mutual respect among the justices. Do you agree?
That's from 2017?
That's from Akhil. No, last month he said that. But
he said it last month?
Yep. Heard him say it, 2 months ago.
2 months ago he said they have great collegiality and they all love each other?
Yep.
Okay. Well,
he said it.
He said it. I would not say it. I don't presume to know what's going on behind the velvet curtain. I really don't. I'm not there. Neither is Akhil, actually. So he might like to think that. I would like to be able to think that. I don't think that. There's something going on at the court that's not healthy. So here we are at the end of March. The court's been in session since the first Monday in October. I think they brought down only 4 decisions so far this year. They had 1 this week. They had 1 last week. They had none until the very end of January. And, you know, they have a lot of cases that are not big salient issues that are going to get people's blood pressure up. They're just like workaday legal issues of the kind that courts have to decide. And they're not deciding them. So I just think they're stuck. I think the leak engendered a lot of mistrust inside. I think, you know, the rapid politicization, the conservative supermajority has engendered a lot of unhappiness, tension inside. And the court well knows that its public approval and public trust have plummeted since the days when indeed the court was consistently the most trusted organ of government, held in the highest esteem. Now, that's still true because the others are so low, but it's not healthy. And, for those of us who care about our working of our government and our civic life, it's quite disturbing.
So what about deference by the court, either to states or to legislatures or to agencies or to precedent? Where is deference surviving and where is it gone?
So the court is accreting, or to put it less politely, grabbing power to itself at an astonishing rate. So the court, for years under the lawyers here, will recognize the Chevron doctrine, which goes back about 35 years. The rule was if an executive branch agency has issued a rule or a policy that is plausibly within the authority that has been given by Congress, we defer. If Congress has done something that's plausibly within its constitutional authority as the lawmaking branch, we defer. That's no longer the case. I mean, the court has not officially overruled the Chevron doctrine, but it hasn't cited it for several years, and it's as good as dead. And it's been replaced by this thing that they, I mean, those justices, call the major question doctrine, which is an anti-deference doctrine that says that if a federal agency has issued a rule or a policy that involves a major question, it's invalid unless Congress has given it explicit authority to do that specific thing. So what's a major question? That's up to the court. The court will tell us what's a major question. And this is made up. It is totally made up notion. It doesn't come from anything. They made it up within the last couple of years, citing the first time the phrase major question was used, which was about 15 years ago. A case came to the court on whether the Food and Drug Administration has the authority to regulate tobacco. And the answer clearly was no, because Congress had never given the FDA that authority, and their efforts in Congress over many years, many efforts to pass legislation to give the FDA that authority, and that legislation had failed. It never passed. So Justice Breyer, writing the opinion in that case called Brown and Williamson Tobacco against FDA, said, you know, this is a major question, and Congress has acted on it in the negative, and so we're not going to interpose ourselves and find authority that Congress has said there's not. I mean, that was like a common sense decision. That phrase, major question, has now been hijacked by the conservatives on the court to mean, we'll tell you, you know, and in the case that came down at the end of this last term, the EPA case in West Virginia, in which the court struck down an effort to regulate coal, you know, major polluting industry emissions. The court said, this is a major question. Consequently, the EPA's action is invalid. And then it gave it, this was, I think, an Alito opinion, gave, it was a Thomas opinion, but Alito, in Alito concurrence, gives us a definition of major question. How do you know it's a major question? Well, he says, it's a major question if it has caused political turmoil. Well, that's ridiculous, because it simply means all you need is a few people to go on Fox and say, this is terrible, and create the turmoil that will then allow the court to say, oh, it's a major question. Well, we have to intervene. So with this kind of thing, and I'm not sure where it's going to go or where it's going to end, but you asked a question about deference, and it's a short question, long answer, but we're in the middle of a real change of signals here that is hard to follow, because it's really in the weeds and it's, you know, buried under a lot of jargon. But administrative law is really where it's at right now. I mean, that's where the rubber meets the road on the conservative revolution on the court in a day in and day out basis. And so, you know, watch that space. It's because it's going to be a lot of action.
Run out of time. I just have two quick questions for you. One is, how do you think the justices will vote if the court hears something about the independent state legislature theory?
Well, they heard it. They heard the this case from North Carolina in December, I think it was. And there's a big question now as to whether they'll proceed to actually decide the case that they granted and heard, because the North Carolina Supreme Court has been captured by the Republicans since then, and is rehearing the election case that triggered this whole controversy. So the court may just back off and undo the grant of review that it had granted. So I'm just not sure.
So that's not a terrifying moment, at least.
Yeah, I mean, now. From the way the argument went, it really seemed to be a bridge too far for even for this crowd. But we don't know yet. It's many balls in the air in that with that issue.
And then my last question is, are there any of these decisions or trends that you think are correct or even necessary?
Do I agree with anything that's going on? must be something, right? Well, I mean, yes, in the sense that, you know, the court not too long ago had something good to say about LGBT rights, both in Obergefell, the same-sex marriage case, and more recently, this surprised many people decision written by Justice Gorsuch that interpreted Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which protects against employment discrimination, to cover gay people and trans people. So, you know, those were good things. Whether we'll see any more good things, I'm not holding my breath right now.
Emily, do we have time to get like two questions from the audience? Okay. Who's got the handheld mics? I know it's going to be really frustrating because we don't have many mics. Wait for Emily and Laura. Emily, you get to choose.
I'm not quite getting a question here.
Why didn't Justice Ginsburg resign?
Well, I guess she would say, why should she? Because she was doing a job that she loved and was doing it quite well. And I think she discerned this effort to get her to resign as some sexist. You know, hey, Ruth, you be the one to take a bullet for the country and leave the job that you love. And I'll say two things about that. She placed two bets, right? She placed a bet that Hillary Clinton was going to get elected president in 2016. I won't take a survey, but I'm willing to bet that a great many of us in this room thought the same thing. Okay, bad for her, but that was her assumption. Secondly, she placed a bet that her health was going to hold out. Had it held out for four more months, President Biden would have picked her successor. I'll say one more thing. It's very easy to blame Ruth Ginsburg's failure to resign for everything we don't like about the court we have now. How about Mitch McConnell? Had he played by the norm that he broke and then rediscovered?
No, we don't have time.
Okay, we're not going to argue, but I just...
Another question.
No, next question.
Sorry.
I've never had a source. Nobody connected to the court has ever told me anything. I pay really close attention. I can read tea leaves, but I've never had a source. That's a fact. I think my good friend, Joan Biskupic, who writes for CNN, and I recommend, she has a new book coming out.
Last year, 2 years ago?
Yeah, she has a new book out, published, I think, next week. She seems to have great sources. She's a good friend of mine, and I would not ever ask her who her sources are. I never did. I just never did.
One more question. Emily, you get to choose.
Good for you. Well, I support term limits. Wouldn't solve our current problem, but life tenure is very unusual in the world. I mean, most other systems have rejected that idea. And I think requiring a supermajority for confirmation, as I said earlier, would really be to the country's benefit. So those are two things I would say.
Now we really have to stop. Thank you, Linda, for having taken us all to law school tonight and for having written such a marvelous and challenging book. Audience, Linda will be signing books in the lobby. Join us. And we'll see you next time with Linda Colley, who will tell us about a wide range of constitutions with very different schemes of balances of power and roles of different judiciaries. Get home safe and be ready to watch tomorrow some real umpires call some real balls and strikes. And thank you, everybody.